You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
Hey, everyone. This is Mark Schaefer. Join me, Mitch Joel, Tom Webster, and so many others at this fall's Social Brand Forum in beautiful Iowa City, Iowa. Every person who attends will get a free copy of my new book, The Content Code. Learn more and register now at socialbrandforum.com. Can't wait to see you there.
Welcome to On Brand, a podcast for brand builders by brand builders. Here's your host, Nick Westergaard of Brand Driven Digital.
Hey, brand builders, have we got a show for you? Today's guest is Josh Miles. Josh is a caffeine and Twitter addict and principal of the newly formed Indianapolis-based branding firm Miles Herndon. His role consists of leading brand strategy, business development, and firm-wide marketing. Josh speaks from coast to coast on branding, digital marketing, and social media, and is a past TEDx presenter. Josh was named as a 40 Under 40 honoree by the Indianapolis Business Journal, Delta Sigma Phi, and a 2015 ENR Midwest Top 20 Under 40. Josh is the author of the Content Marketing Institute book, Bold Brand. Josh serves on the board of directors for the Oasis Network, an international church planting and resourcing organization, and is the National Speaker Series chair for AAF Indianapolis. Josh is also involved in several other startup tech companies in Indianapolis. Prior to forming Miles Herndon, Josh ran Miles Design for nearly 13 years before deciding to join forces with another firm called Redwall. Josh has also served as an art director and as an adjunct faculty for IUPUI, Heron School of Art and Design, and the Art Institute of Indianapolis. Josh is a longtime member of AIGA, the Professional Association for Design, serving 3 years as the Indianapolis chapter president. Josh is currently involved in SMPS, Verge, and Rainmakers. His unique point of view on branding, design, and marketing has been sought after by organizations, corporations, and university design programs for keynote, guest lecture, and training exercises. Josh, welcome to On Brand.
Nick, it's so great to be here. Thank you.
So I always have to ask someone that ends up so squarely positioned in the branding world, in brand camp, there has to be something called that, right?
I would hope so.
Someone's done that. But with both feet so squarely planted in this world of brand camp that we've made up, how did you get here?
It sounds pretty committed, doesn't it? I think I'm one of the weird guys that, you know, I grew up in high school, probably like a lot of designers, drawing and illustrating stuff. And my father, who's a financial services guy, said, Josh, it's great that you want to do something with your art, with air quotes, but you're going to have to find somebody to pay you to do that. So I stumbled upon a video of some ad agency pitching a luxury automobile spot to a client. And it showed how they got shot down in the pitch. And for some reason, I thought that sounded really interesting. And I'd love to try those kind of challenges. So I decided there's this thing called design. And quickly in school, I learned that branding was a big part of how you get those design visuals and kind of make a business of it. And something I just completely fell in love with. And now I'm sort of committed at this point, I guess.
Yeah, it's funny you mention, you know, seem pretty firmly planted. And I was looking at my own bio for something recently, which sounds really, really vain, you know, to kind of sit back. And I was reading my bio, but only for the sake of I had like the word brand or branding. It just too many times. It's like I've got to subtract a couple of these. It's got to be a little less brandy.
It can't be any more brandy than it already is.
Exactly, exactly. So you talk about the graphic design side of things. And I think, you know, one of my favorite eye-rolling moments, being someone else that's firmly planted in the branding world, is you hear people talk about how we've rebranded, and you probe deeper and you learn that, oh, they have a new logo. And I think the visuals are interesting because they are so critical, but some people oversimplify, like it's something like a new coat of paint. And then you look at this and look at, you know, the digital world that we live in, and I kind of wonder, what is the role that visuals play today?
I think that's a great question. I think, like you said, branding and rebranding has to be more than visuals. But I think the visuals are interesting because it's really the thing that signals to people on the outside that something on the inside has changed. And it's the way that you kind of signal to the market or to your competition or to your peers, hey, you guys should pay attention to what we're doing because we don't look the same that we used to. And I think if all that changed was how they look, then that's obviously going to fall a little bit flat. And we've seen plenty of examples of, you know, the Gap from a few years ago or lots of other famous examples of logo redesign fails. But I think when something really changes on the inside, that external visual change is a really great way to signal that to the market.
You talk about kind of the visuals and, you know, the logo is a big part of that. But how do you describe, I mean, I feel like I kind of lose people sometimes. I'm, for the record, not a designer by skill set. I work with them. Or they put up with me. But I feel like I can speak the language. And I feel like when you're talking with clients, with businesses, and you start talking about, you know, a visual brand ecosystem, you kind of see the eyes glaze over and they're like, tell me about my logo. So, right. So how do you kind of break that down for, you know, what the visuals mean beyond that cornerstone of a logo?
I think one of the best ways to explain it is to start big picture and say, okay, let's imagine that we've rebranded and it's a year from today and everything's fantastic. When we talk about a brand identity system, I want to lay out all the pieces that we did for you, and I want to see that they look like they belong together, but it's a family. You know, everybody's not identical twins. Everything doesn't have to be the exact same shade of solid blue with the logo centered in the middle. I want to see some variety of how this brand works with images, how it works with big type, how it works with small type, how it works on a business card or a long form print piece. I want to see your website. And all of those things should look like they belong together within that brand identity system. But I don't want to feel like somebody just stamped the logo on everything that wasn't moving.
You know, that's interesting because I think that's another visual branding misnomer or oversight beyond the fact that branding is just the logo, that branding consistently is, you know, stamping that everywhere, making sure that we have that one color on everything. And it seems like, you know, that's kind of taking things to the extreme, but also not necessarily doing the job effectively, right?
Yeah, we've got this a client from a couple of years ago was giving us a tour of their space while it was still under construction. We had just gotten an approved new logo from them, so they were excited to use their new color on all of their walls. And as he was touring us through the building, he would point to one wall and say, "We're going to put a little branding over there, and we're going to put a little more branding over here." And he was completely serious. It was just so hard to keep a straight face as he was describing the, I don't know, I suppose we're going to stick the logo on every other wall was what he meant. But
yeah, Well, it's interesting because with all of these visual kind of that's why my odd disclaimer that I am not a designer, but I think because I also, you know, pepper my bio with branding and it's my bailiwick. I think there's some people that even oversimplify maybe what I do and, oh, he must be a design person. But it's interesting. So what would you say then is key to consistency visually for a brand, you know, beyond just, I like the idea of the branding ingredients. Sprinkle a bit here, sprinkle a bit there. We've got branding everywhere.
Who wants more branding? No, I think we talk about it more from the standpoint of even the order of operations makes a difference on how the brand gets executed. So really, if you start with obviously business objectives and strategy, and then you build that brand story and message around that idea. So you're really starting to position the brand completely with words before you even start to put visuals to it or ever talk about typefaces or colors. I think you end up with a much more strategic approach to how those visuals get done and in what direction or what options you would even want to show a client if you're, as opposed to, I'm going to go off in my little dark room and make a great logo and come back to you. And they say, oh, that's great. But now who are we and what do we stand for? And how, you know, how should this brand sound? I think you've got to decide all those other things up front to get it, the job done right.
I love the concept of order of operations, but that might surprise some people. That's math. You know, that's the art guy's not supposed to talk about math.
Don't bring numbers into a branding conversation. That's heresy.
Well, it's interesting that, you know, as we look at all of this in kind of the digital arena, and you mentioned an example, I actually, it comes up in my mind quite a bit. You talk about the Gap example, and it's so easy to remember. Oh, I remember that awful Gap logo. And and I, every now and then I kind of have I kind of question that, how that all came out. Because part of me wonders, was it that bad? I mean, typographically, it was not awful. And, you know, the little blue off-kilter box thing. I could see what they were going for, but it's like they were just, it's trying to think of something on par with that where I've seen a brand that torn apart, but then I think their own response, like just kind of, cause you know, their immediate kind of backpedaling. Oh, we didn't mean that.
Just kidding. Just
yeah.
Kidding.
It was this other thing. Just an experiment for right over here. And then we'll just never mention it again.
I think that's what made it so clear that they didn't have any strategy behind that change, that it was just simply an act of decoration. Cause if they had really had that baked into where they were going, and there was really reasoning behind that identity, they would have never pulled the plug on it. They would have said, screw you guys. This is who we are. This is what we're doing. And sorry if you don't like it, but this is what the Gap's about. And clearly it had nothing to do with that.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, there was nothing behind it. It was, you know, the emperor's new clothes. And it makes me think in this environment, as we're branding and rebranding specifically in some of these cases and, you know, launching these concepts out there, do we need to package that up more? I'm you know, the other example I think of is when Starbucks dropped the Starbucks coffee, the words out of their out of the mermaid, and they released it with a Howard Schultz video talking about it, taking you through time and talking kind of about vision stuff and how, you know, beyond just kind of a refreshed approach, it, you know, was really signaling their move into perhaps other spaces. You know, do you think that that's required today?
I think it really is, especially when you've got a brand like Starbucks with such passionate brand advocates, or maybe there are a few of those, and maybe just a lot of people that Starbucks is part of their daily routine. Maybe they didn't, you know, maybe not that many people actually care what the logo looks like. But I think for them, you know, in sharp contrast to the Gap, they rolled that out and were completely behind it. And I'm sure there are plenty of people who whined about it or didn't love it, but they were so steadfast in the changes there, and they've never looked back. And now nobody outside of us branding guys even remember it happened.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, and in that you talk about them being behind it completely. And you know what? You know that seems like it could be an issue for some too. You know, how can you get there? Because I think a lot of times, like you said, I'm sure there's people internally that thought that was the worst thing ever. And, you know, culturally they move past it. And I think that these visuals, these signals, like you were talking about earlier, you know, you do have to, I'm repeating myself, get behind them. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that's not easy. How can organizations ensure that they are all marching in the same direction, reading from the same hymnal?
Well, I think you have to have a hymnal to read from in the first place. And most companies probably haven't taken the time to pen that yet.
So this is interesting because I feel like, you know, we're breaking down kind of this big, squishy, nebulous branding thing into some very specific things, because it's like it's sometimes, like you said, a little branding here, a little branding there. But you talk about all of these different elements. Then we talk about the concept of the hymnal. And I think sometimes it's like, oh yeah, that's the style guide that has, you know, the Pantone colors, the fonts, and how much clearance the logo needs. But what else belongs in a hymnal like that for a brand? You know, for those that don't know the colloquialism, we're obviously talking about, you know, some sort of, I even struggle with this term. I mean, what's your favorite label here? Are we talking about brand standards?
Yeah, guidelines? I mean, I think we use about 5 different terms for it here interchangeably, just between which one of us you ask for. So maybe maybe we need our own style guide just for branding terms. But
cool, that would be helpful.
I think having, you know, obviously more than just the visual identity, it's not just the corporate style guidelines. It should be also about voice and positioning. So we always like to include some really simple positioning statements within the brand guidebook, so that really becomes kind of that verbal or the compass of words. So everybody knows visually and message-wise, voice and tone-wise, where to take pieces in the future. It doesn't have to mean that they all came out of some robotic algorithm, so it sounds completely unhuman. But I think, you know, at least deciding intentionally, do we have a sense of humor with this brand, or is it really serious, or is it very helpful, or is it maybe it's a little bit of all of those things? And if so, how should it sound, so that when I read the About Us page or I, you know, see a YouTube video, does it sound like it came from the same voice?
That's interesting, because I think the visuals people can see, the voice we don't think about as much. But I mean, those are the, you talk about the, my favorite soundbite of many thus far is that we need our own style guide for branding terms. But being a word guy myself, I always kind of like the alliteration of, you know, the visuals and the voice, of needing both of those and understanding how they work together. Because I mean, everything is visual, you know, both in terms of platforms that we control online and off, but also our voice, what we're saying there, and all of these different places that we're saying it, and that it's not something, I mean, especially you talk about, I don't know if you've observed this in your work, but I mean, on the agency side of things, you know, it used to be that it was so much more controlled who can speak for the brand.
All right.
You know, that it's, oh, it's the copywriter, you know, that's, you know, at our agency, that's who knows what we sound like. And, you know, now we see, you know, internal teams managing social media, engaging on Facebook, Twitter, and elsewhere. You all have to sound, like you said, like they belong together, like they're, like it's the same person talking.
And at the same time, you don't want to lock it down to where, you know, the guys in the management team or the C-suite would feel intimidated to blog. You know, you want them to be, you want their voice to be their voice, but, you know, they're speaking as part of the brand. So, you know, it's just, it's an interesting line that you need to walk, but I think it's, you know, it's not that individual people within a brand, within a company, can't have their own unique spin on things.
Well, I like what you said too about not locking it down too much, because I think that that's, you know, we start talking about branding and then it's, we jump to consistency. And a few different guests in recent months have talked about the idea of consistency versus coherence.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I get that on a basic level, but I feel like I'm still kind of unpacking what it means. So again, it's that continuation of, it's not that we've painted that wall that color and put a logo on it, that it's, because like you said, you can go too far. You know, you can lock things down too much. And it is this odd, you know, it's again, it's the art and science of branding. But I feel like a lot of these answers, a lot of these topics that we as brand builders are describing sort of close up with, you know, with you saying, you know, but it's this space between, and that's a tricky space to navigate.
Well, I think whether it's the visuals or the messaging or all of your collateral and assets, great brands demonstrate unity and not uniformity.
Oh, okay. So talk a bit more about that, about unity versus uniformity.
Well, I think uniformity is kind of, as I was describing before, if you lay everything out, then it all just looks like the exact same thing. And I think unity is, there are plenty of things that tie it together. You know, when a Target commercial comes on television, well before you've ever, you know, seen the bullseye at the end, like, you know that it's Target. You get the fun music and even the visual treatments. You just understand from the visuals and the tone that this is going to be a Target commercial. And I think it becomes a little bit confusing when their competition starts to emulate that more and more. You know, I see a Kohl's spot or JCPenney, and I think it's Target. And then at the end, it's not. And it makes me think, Target, which is probably not what the other guys are shooting for.
Well, it's interesting. You talk about the signals, and I think, you know, you talk about the different disservices that you can do. And, you know, we talked about the Gap not having anything behind what they launched. I think another misstep is, you know, you see the competition, you know, whether it's Kohl's, whoever else, is seeing those visuals and saying, I mean, because we know this happens. You know, I want some of that. Do some of that for us. And I mean, it's beyond just saying, oh, they copied us. It doesn't work. You can't just do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, as branding guys, it's our job to understand what those most important touch points are and to be very aware of what the competitors are doing. Because if we're, you know, preaching differentiation and how to help somebody stand out, and we turn around and create something that looks just like a competitor, I think we've done everybody a disservice.
So you talked about there being many points that can bring unity to a brand. Just to kind of close that concept out, whereas uniformity is again, it's all the walls are this color. We have everybody wearing a shirt with that logo on it, and we've just kind of... What's the best kind of way to unpack the uniformity concept?
Yeah, I think uniformity is when they're all clones. You know, when it's there's no creativity. There's no I think it's maybe an absence of understanding context.
Yeah.
So you're really just applying the same solution to every problem for the brand, where each of those touch points probably has a better way to solve the problem, as opposed to just finding the last thing you did and apply the logo to the shirt the same way we did to the coffee mug, you know.
Get it on the shirt. it's interesting because I think about that, and I think that that's where a lot of these, I don't want to say negative, but misguided views of branding come from. Because I think the other, in our style guide for branding terms, I think we all kind of roll our eyes and sigh a bit when we hear people talking about the brand police, the brand Nazis. And I think it's because they're thinking of it in that uniformity, you know, that it's that you just have to clone everything and that there are these lines that you have to color in, as opposed to, like you said, context. It's trickier to navigate.
Yeah, it's probably somewhere at either extreme, too. It's either a client who says, who thinks that it's as simple as stamping the logo on everything, or it's a client who's worked with a designer before who had that approach to it, and they think, well, I don't want to have my hands tied on every piece. Just give me the logo and I'll go figure out how to use it.
Well, and when you talk about management too, and, you know, uniformity, you know, applying the logo to everything, you can sort of see almost where they're coming from, because I'm sure they're thinking, ah, that branding thing, we've got to do that. What's our checklist? Let's get all the stuff done. Put the logo on all the things. Now we're done. We're done with branding.
Okay, we did the branding. Check.
Next. So, you know, that's another good topic, too, because, you know, what? Because I think sometimes we think, you know, what do people like Josh do? You know, they've already got a new logo. What's the in-between look like? You know, what's he doing the rest of the time between branding, rebranding, and all of that? I mean, what is the, you know, the day-to-day of being in the brand business?
Well, I think the interesting thing is, you know, especially in a world where you have clients, so a for-profit business, you have so many people, you know, every prospect and client is not in the same mental place. So some clients really early in the buy-sell process need really different things than somebody who's almost ready to sign versus somebody who's a long-term advocate for your company. And from a design and branding and marketing standpoint, there are so many tools and pieces we could create to better, just for example, to better serve referrals. I mean, how many companies get most of their work because of referrals or word of mouth? So what are we doing from a branding standpoint to grease that wheel, to make it easier for clients to think of us first and make it easy for them to make that introduction or the handoff?
It's interesting because referrals, you know, immediately makes me think he's talking sales language now. You've talked about math and words. I mean, you're not being a good visual guy here, because now you're talking about sales, actual hard sales. And you know, what is the role of, you know, you talk about something like referrals of, you know, that sales process, again, a very deep, critical core business function. What role does branding play in connection to things like referrals?
Well, I think the thinking about sales is something that comes from when I started my company. It was just me. So I went from being an art director at an ad agency with one job, which was to make great looking ads and, you know, design pieces, to all of a sudden I was the sales guy. And by the way, the accounting guy and the, you know, taking out the trash and whatever else. And every now and then when I had spare time, I could actually design stuff. So it kind of changes how you look at this business in the whole, and really start to see it in a more holistic way of, you know, if you're going to get these great branding clients and get a chance to do these really great projects, first of all, you've got to go find them. And then you've got to tell them all about why you, and help them understand how you can help them solve their problems before you ever get a chance to start thinking about colors and typefaces.
Kind of seems like sometimes that those viewpoints of, you know, the branding stereotype and the sales stereotype, both of which I don't think are, I like both, and like you, I like to consider myself, you know, like you, I had to learn kind of some of that other side, but you know, that both, neither party is what that stereotype is, that there's, you know, that hard-nosed salesperson and that kind of fluffy branding person out there kind of doing these things that are nice to haves but not need to haves. But it seems like sometimes they're positioned internally at organizations at odds with one another, these two parties.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think it's easy to see just the strategy piece, especially on the client side, to think, man, what is this strategy thing? I mean, can't we figure that out ourselves?
Yeah.
And then the design is, you know, can somebody who really values strategy often devalues what the designer is focused on.
Well, it sounds cliche, but you know, the sales and the branding side of things, but it's almost like a yin and a yang. It's like I can't imagine them working effectively, you know, without being tied together. You know, that you've got a shell of something. I'm trying to think of an example of some organization with a powerful sales competency that isn't backed up with an impeccable brand.
Yeah, I mean, it really is chocolate and peanut butter. I think it's the two things that I think make the, I'm not going to use the word synergy, makes the
will not use
makes
synergy.
The whole better. You know, it's they, when used together properly, although they seem like they could be opposites, I think it makes for a really powerful organization.
So is there a way to help those parties understand one another better?
I mean, we do this really strange thing, and we talk to our clients and we interview them. So we try to get, you know, the big groups, maybe sometimes it's a couple of different groups, maybe it's a leadership team, and then later it's a marketing communications team. And then we try to get one-on-one interviews just over the phone and kind of create that almost confessional atmosphere where you ask them a couple easy questions to start with. But really we're looking for internally, what are the pain points, and what do you think about this organization? What do you think about this brand? And then we'll go out and interview just as many of their clients or customers and ask them similar questions. So really we're looking for, what are those overlapping points? What are those common areas?
Interesting. And what do you do once you identify some of those common areas?
So the overlap is really where the greatest opportunity is for messaging that's going to be sticky, in my mind. So it's things that we think about ourselves that our customers are already saying. So those are the really obvious places where you're going to have the easiest time ramping up. And I think where you've got the areas that they don't match up, those are the areas to go, I wonder why our customers don't say that about us, or why do we think this and we're not hearing it back from the market?
It's interesting. You talk about what our customers are already saying, because that is among the most powerful copy that you can find out there. And I think that's a big thing that's changed. But what is the role of the customer on the brand building side of things, since we do have this unprecedented access to actually, you know, you talked about, we do this revolutionary thing, we talk to our clients. We can also do this revolutionary thing now and talk to our customers much easier than it was before. We don't have to convene a focus group. So how does that, I mean, because it also seems like there's a double-edged sword there. You know, at what point is the tail wagging the dog on, you know, customer input into the brand?
Well, I think you can take the Steve Jobs or Henry Ford approach and say, we know what the market wants better than the market knows, but I don't think it hurts to get a hint from the market. It doesn't mean that focus groups should drive everything that you do, but I think it's just a really nice temperature check to talk to a few of those key clients. It's not necessarily, you know, surveying the masses. It's when we talk to our best clients and our best customers, what do they have to say about us and how do they feel? Why would they choose us over somebody else? And why might they occasionally choose someone else over us?
Well, again, it makes me think of the password for this episode of the podcast. You've talked a lot about context, because I think, what context are you? I mean, if you're just kind of like having the masses vote on everything, that doesn't seem like it's too smart. But if you're, like you said, getting some feedback from some of your core customers, that seems like better context to make some informed decisions.
I think it's almost, you know, to get into another heretical world, to use, you know, A/B testing within marketing. Actually, you know, do you like this better or do you like that better? Again, it's just understanding who is most excited about our brand, and let's make sure we know what they think about us before we, you know, go changing our logo at the Gap.
So what are some of the most important things? Like if you were getting a project and you wanted to know, you know, you could get these specific data points from the audience that you're serving, you know, what is most critical? What do you look to most?
I think, you know, we're often trying to get to, what is it about this brand or this company that you get that you don't get from anyone else? And maybe within a certain sector, you might say, well, everybody's just about the same. But there's got to be something that really tips the scales for why you would choose product A or brand A over brand B. And so, you know, are they the only blank that does blank? Are they the first ones that you saw do something? Did you see them do something better than previous vendors? And, you know, really try to get to the heart of how that decision, that buying decision was made.
You've also talked, spoken, written about branding for professional services firms. And I think sometimes it's easier, back to the, it's easier to, pun intended, grasp tangibles, you know, all these consumer packaged goods companies that we're talking about, but professional services can be somewhat elusive. How is branding different for professional service firms?
Yeah, it's an elusive thing for sure. And it's something that we kind of fell into by accident. We just got introduced to a couple of interior design firms to start with. And we thought, man, that'd be really cool. The visuals of these great interiors with our design, let's do that. So we did a couple of these, and then we would get hired by a bigger architecture firm, and then that would win an award. And then we'd get hired by an even bigger engineering firm and accounting firm. And so all of these different service providers, and a lot of them in the architecture, engineering, and construction, they refer to that as the AEC industry. You know, this is just where we've made a really big name for ourselves in that space. But it is a very different animal than when you have a product that sits on a shelf. So you're really selling expertise of the firm on the whole. And then you're also trying to elevate some of these thought leaders or subject matter experts within the firm as well.
That's interesting, talking about the difference in what you're selling, the products versus the expertise. Does that always come easily to the principals in those organizations? The idea of, because I sometimes find that when in making that sale, that there's, maybe it's a Midwestern thing, there's some reluctance to, oh, I don't know that I'm an expert. I don't know that I'm all of that. Is it tricky to be the expert?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's maybe even trickier to elevate the quote unquote experts who are not principals or owners, because man, if we tell everybody how great of an engineer Bob is, Bob's going to get picked up by a different firm who's going to offer him 20% more salary or whatever. And the nice thing is, I think we're getting to a point in time where most firms are realizing, you know, if they want to hire Bob, he's probably on LinkedIn and can probably go find him there. So I always tell firms, if you focus more on building a great company culture and spend less time worrying about your guys getting poached, then you're going to have a lot more success.
Yeah, that's always a tricky one. You know, it's like a mindset too. I, you know, worked with a publisher once who was, you know, did a lot of free sampling of textbooks. And, you know, they were so concerned with, you know, making sure that someone couldn't screw them out of an extra book or something. And it's like, I don't know how to, it's a tough mindset to crack, because it's the same thing with the, you know, if you're really worried about someone going, you know, you're not going to magically keep them here.
Yeah. And I think from a, it kind of goes back to culture, I think has to be part of that brand as well. So it's, you know, what it means to work in this firm and why, especially in the professional services world, it's something that we're pushing a lot with our clients, that we don't want to just put up this corporate face. We want to let people see into it a little bit, because ultimately it's people who are going to be working with more people. So we need to show what it's going to be like both to work with us and to work for us.
You talk about culture and we're talking about people. I think that, you know, also in this branding style guide that neither of us have put together yet, it also run across the term of brand ambassadors. Mm-hmm. And especially as we talk about things on the digital social side of things, you know, we want to create these brand ambassadors. But what's the trick in doing that?
Well, first you have to find a sash that they can wear around.
Good.
And it has to be, you know, the correct Pantone color.
Right.
So I think if we crack those two nuts, then I think we're well on our way. No, I think it's, you know, just paying attention to your market. So we know that we have some super fans who follow us on Twitter. And if we say something or post something, that they'll like it or they'll share it. And I think most every company has that. And, you know, hopefully it's more than just your mom. But, you know, identifying who those people are and interacting with them and, you know, giving back and, you know, not just in a, well, they did it, so I guess we have to. But, you know, actually creating some relationship opportunities with them and for other people who pay attention. So, you know, it's just kind of basic social media courtesy, I suppose.
Well, I think that that's another place where it's like there's this fork in the road, and which side of the thinking are you going to come down on? Like you said, the people that are going to put their employees out there, you know, to demonstrate, position their expertise, are the ones that are going to get scared that they're going to get poached. I think on the other side, like what you're talking about, is very few have done kind of what you call basic social media, because instead of focusing on how we can identify and build up those super fans, you know, it almost seems like sometimes we spend a disproportionate amount of time on what happens if someone says something bad about us.
Yeah, I think if you focused more on just being out there, you know, I think the companies who people get on and say something bad about are probably the ones who are generally dark most days. Or it's an airline, because everybody loves to rip on their latest airline trip.
Right, right. That's, you know, that would be a tricky brand to be. But so as we start to wrap up here, what is a brand that has made you smile lately?
Oh, man, that's a good question. My wife and I are coming to a end of building a home. This is actually the third house that we've built in our 15-year marriage. So we're really good at moving.
Wow.
But this brand that our interior designer turned us on to is called Dot and Bow. Are you familiar with these guys?
No.
So Dot and Bow is one of those, I think you have to be a member to even look around, but it's a very, very well curated set of interior decor and furniture and whatnot. And what's really cool about them is they curate these collections. So like today, I think, was their industrial style furniture, but it came in this great email and it said, read the manifesto. So you click through and you read this industrial furniture manifesto and decide like, yeah, I think I could decorate my house like this. And what you're doing is basically brainwashing yourself to think you've got to buy all industrial furniture now. But I think they do such a fabulous job with not just collecting these groups of styles. You know, if you want something mid-century modern or something that looks like a California ranch, you know, they have all these really cool collections. But they've done a great job of creating this story around each of these collections as well. And then, of course, I think doing a great job with email marketing just caps it all off.
Email. That's one of my favorite ones. It's like I feel like it's kind of like the less attractive older sibling of social media. You know, we give that all kinds of time, but email is still, I think, a great place to do some really great things. But again, we spend a disproportionate amount of time elsewhere sometimes, it seems.
Yeah, I think it's like if you're a fan of the Marvel Spider-Man movies at all, with great power comes great responsibility. And I think that's especially true with email.
Oh, yeah.
That you can just ruin somebody's life with email.
That's a great point. Yes, as powerful as the tool it is, you could also do probably even more negative things there as well. If you don't heed Uncle Ben's advice,
that's right. Gotta listen to Uncle Ben.
So, Josh, where can folks go to learn more about who you are and what you do?
Oh, we are at milesherndon.com is our agency site. That's MILESHERNDON. And I'm at Josh Miles on Twitter.
Awesome. Well, we will link up to all of that in our show notes. Josh, thanks for being on brand with us.
My pleasure.
And before we go, I always like to flip the microphone around to our listeners. Recently, Mark Greenlaw gave us a shout on Twitter for our recent episode focused on brand storytelling featuring Park Howell. Thanks for listening, Mark. And a reminder, if you heard something that you liked on this episode or another, or if you have a question you'd like our guest to answer, let me know on Twitter using the hashtag OnBrandPodcast. You may just hear your thoughts right here on the show. Last but not least, as I said, I'll link up to everything over at branddrivendigital.com. While there, you can also find information for how to subscribe to the show via iTunes, Stitcher, and RSS. Speaking of iTunes, if you like what you're hearing, head over, give us a quick rating and review, click that 5-star button, drop in a few sentences. We'd love to know what you think about the show. And don't forget that this podcast is brought to you by our industry-leading social brand forum. Save $100 by using promo code ONBRAND when you register at socialbrandforum.com. Until next week, I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This has been the On Brand Podcast, presented by Brand Driven Digital. For show notes, links, and more, go to onbrandpodcast.com. Remember, you can subscribe to the show and leave a rating and review at iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.